Let's jump back into Genesis chapter 14 as we see how things turned out after Abram had rescued his nephew Lot. Remember, the story was that this invasion from Mesopotamia was trying to retake control of the valley of Sidim, the valley of cultivated fields, which is where the five cities of the plain were located, Sodom, Gomorrah, all the other cities, where I think the north basin of the Dead Sea now exists. They came down and did a little J-curve and hooked around and came toward the cities of the plain from the west. And there was a big battle, and the five kings of the plain lost. Their forces were routed. A lot of people got stuck in the tar pits that were part of that region. The rest of them escaped off into what we call Moab later in the scripture, into the hills toward the east. And then the Mesopotamians took all the stuff they wanted, plus they took slaves, including Lot, and headed back north. Abram gets wind of this, and he gets up a militia force that he has at least 318 of his own guys involved, plus his friends. So we have a really pretty decent sized battalion regiment sized force that pursues them all the way up to Dan up in the north, attacks them and routes them all the way past Damascus and recaptures all the lost material as well as the lost peoples. And then Abram is ready to head south again. It should be noted that his route does not take him back to Sodom. There was no intention on his part to go back to that area. His path, which takes him past the ancient city of Salim, which would be where Jerusalem is eventually, shows that he was on his way back to his place, to Hebron, whenever the king of Sodom catches up with him and asks him for all the recovered peoples. So let's go ahead and read next Genesis chapter 14, verse 16. And by the way, I place this in my chronology in the year 2091 BC. Then he brought back all the possessions, and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, and the women, and the people, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaweh, that is the king's valley. Now, the king's valley, by tradition, and I think with good biblical reason, is equated with the Kidron Valley, which is immediately east of the ancient city of Salem or Jebus or Jerusalem. And there are some very ancient Canaanite walls that you can see if you ever go there and visit. I would hope you'd come with me. I always find it interesting to go and be in this area. But on my first trip to Israel, the tour guide owner was with us as we went down into the tunnels of the ancient city of Jerusalem, and he pointed out, you are now down by the walls that existed in the time of Abraham, and it was here that the first communion took place. And we all kind of looked with puzzlement at him. He says, well, Abraham brought out wine and bread and shared it with Abram, the king of Salem, which Melchizedek brought out wine and bread and shared it with Abram. That sounds like a communion ceremony to me. And we all had to smile and say, yeah, that's an interesting take on things, Omer. We're not quite to that part of the story yet, but I want you to know there is good reason to believe that that's pretty much where this meeting happened, was right there next to the walls of ancient Salem. Verse number 18, Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. Now, the book of Hebrews makes a very big deal out of Melchizedek. He makes him into a type of Christ, a symbolic vision or version of Christ in the Old Testament. He wasn't Jesus, but rather a symbol of him. Melchi is Hebrew for king. Zedek is righteousness, so his name means king of righteousness. The city which apparently he founded is Salem, which means peace. And so he is both the king of righteousness and the king of peace. And so that's why the writer of Hebrews likes to use him as a good illustration of Jesus. But back to the actual story here in Genesis 14. We know that Melchizedek was a genuine believer in the one true God, which is unusual in this part of the world at this time. And it also means that he and Abram are on the same page. They worship the same Creator God, God Most High. And so it's not surprising at all that they would have this meeting of fellowship and would share bread and wine together. And yes, I suppose in a way that makes it communion, doesn't it? Because they were communing together with their relationship with God Most High. I am of the opinion, and that's all it's worth, as I often tell you, that these gentlemen have already met before. By this time, Abram has been in Canaan for about 10 years. And yeah, he made a brief trip down to Egypt, and he has had his encampment up at Shechem, and he has had his encampment up at Bethel, and he has had his encampment down by Hebron, but that doesn't mean that he hasn't had regular contact with the priest of God Most High at Salem. So I think that this meeting is not their first. I think it indicates some sort of relationship that's already been established, that Melchizedek would want to come out and do something special with Abram as he comes back from this victory. He might have stopped by on the way north and asked for him to be praying about this. So verse number 19, he blessed him. That is, Melchizedek blessed Abram. And he said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." So it is a thanksgiving meeting, it is a thanksgiving ceremony, which again makes me wonder whether or not they had this past relationship and that perhaps Abram stopped here on his way to do the attack and said, "Would you please pray to God with me and for me that I can rescue my nephew and rescue the people that were taken away?" And so this would be a fantastic thanksgiving. And then Abram gave him, Melchizedek, a tenth of everything. This is the first recorded instance in Scripture of a tithe, but that doesn't necessarily mean that tithing started here. It could be that tithing had been going on for a long time. It might have been something learned way back in the past, that when you are worshiping the one true God and you know of somebody that is working in their service, you should help them out. And so Abram gives him 1/10 of all the spoils of war that he's collected. And Melchizedek accepts it and continues his work there. Now, that's the last we hear of Melchizedek in the book of Genesis. It's the last that we hear of him in the Old Testament, except for one psalm that talks about him, which the book of Hebrews plays on that psalm and says that Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecy in the psalm that God has said, "You are my son, you are a priest after the order of Melchizedek, an everlasting priest." So Melchizedek pops into our story momentarily, and then he's just as quickly gone. But I want you to know, I think he was actively working for God Most High in the area during this time. When next in the history of Jerusalem, we come to this area, it will be for the sacrifice of Isaac. And then the next time after that is going to be finally when Jerusalem is destroyed by Joshua, because it's a stronghold of the Jebusites, the sinful peoples. So the work of Melchizedek at this time is eventually eclipsed by the evil of the Canaanites of the region later. Let's continue. Verse 21. The king of Sodom said to Abram, did you forget about him? Remember, he caught up with Abram here. So somehow he gets wind wherever he's at. Perhaps he's already returned to Sodom, to the city, once he knows that the Mesopotamians have headed back north again. He gets wind that Abram has attacked those forces up in the north, and he's coming back with all the captives and all the material, and he's not coming to Sodom. He's heading down to Hebron past Salem. So the king of Sodom cuts across the Jordan Valley and goes over and catches up with Abram here, and then says to him this in verse 21. Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself. So you can keep the stuff you collected that originally belonged to us, but I want my citizens, which is an interesting, nice thing for him to do. But Abram is not interested in taking his stuff in that sort of context. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted my hand to he who is. Now remember, the divine name didn't exist back at the time that these events happened. So more than likely, he said something like, I have lifted my hand to God Most High, El Shaddai, which would be in the Hebrew probably the way of saying my God. So I have lifted my hand to my God, who is God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I should not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you say, I have made Abram rich. So when it's offered to him, he says, I'm not taking that stuff as some sort of payment from you, because I do not want you saying that you are my benefactor, that you somehow are the reason why I am doing so well. So instead he says this, verse 24, I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten, meaning his military force is 318 militiamen. They would have eaten out of the plunder, daily meals and things like that. And the share of the men who went with me, let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share. The ancient rules of warfare was to the winner goes the spoils. So when you won, you got to take all the stuff of the other side. It was yours. It was part of the reparations for what they had done to you in the warfare. So Abram says, I am going to forego my right to the plunder because you've attached it to somehow you helping me out. So I'll let my guys, they get to keep what they put in their bellies. But I can't speak for my allies. They have the right to keep their plunder. That's between you and them. And we don't know how that turned out. Verse 1 of chapter 15. Abram goes back to Hebron, back to the trees of Mamre, and God immediately appears to him in a dream, or it seems to be in a dream. And it starts by making reference to fear and protection. And so I'm going to suggest to you that perhaps Abram got back home and he got to thinking about what he just did. He just ambushed and did great damage to an allied military force from Mesopotamia that had controlled the region of the Siddim Valley for the past 12 years before they rebelled. So this is a very powerful group. And even though he did them great damage and probably weakened them greatly, Abram might have been thinking, what happens if they get reinforcements and come back down here and start hunting for me to take vengeance on me? And so that could have been a very scary prospect when you're pondering such things. Pardon me again. So it's at this moment that God talks to him. Chapter 15, verse 1. After these things, the word of He Who Is came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. So there we have, don't be afraid. And remember, I'm the one protecting you. So that kind of matches what I was just saying, that things might have been going through his mind to make God want to assure him everything will be okay. And then he says this, your reward shall be very great. Now that also mixes into the story because he just gave up a whole bunch of booty, a whole bunch of plunder. And God says, don't worry about that even. I'm the one that's going to reward you. I will take good care of you. But then we find out that something else has been rolling around in the father of faith's head. Now remember, we think of him as the father of faith, but he is still fairly young in that faith, we gather. He's only been in the promised land for about 10 years, and it doesn't seem as if he had come into faith of the one true God many years before he left to come here. So I'm guessing he is a much younger believer than I am. I have been a Christian for almost 50 years now. And so Abram is a much younger believer than I am. Some of you might have been believers for 20 or 30 years. I'm guessing that Abram is a much younger believer than you. And so younger believers sometimes, even though they have faith, will let a little bit of doubt and uncertainty and anxiety kind of get a hold of their heads. And so this is what he says back to God. Abram said, oh, my master, He Who Is. So somehow he says, without using the divine name, something about God being his master. What will you give me? for I continue childless. The heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." So he effectively says back, "But God, no matter what you give me, how is that helping? Because I don't have a body heir. I don't have a child of my own flesh that I can pass all that stuff on to. Right now, my heir, the person that is going to be in charge of my household after my death, is Eliezer. And this Eliezer seems to be a long-standing retainer of Abram. He might have come with him from Ur of the Chaldees. We don't know. Now, a lot of the commentaries are going to say, well, he comes from Damascus. But I'm a little bit puzzled by something that I see in the text here in the Hebrew. Because Eliezer's name is not Eliezer of Damascus, but rather Damascene Eliezer. So it's a little reversed of what you'd expect if Damascus is telling you where Eliezer came from. Instead, it seems to be Damascus is describing Eliezer. And when you go to the wording, Damascus means blood sack, and it was probably the way you would describe the rare birth of somebody that the amniotic sac is still in place when they're born. And also, sometimes the sac might break, but it comes out wrapped around the top of the head like some sort of cap. And I think that's even the terminology that gets used today when a baby is born in this fashion, is that they've got a cap on. So it seems to me more likely that this is a nickname for Eliezer. Blood sack head Eliezer, the guy that was born with the sack of his mother's womb on his head. And if that's the case, there's another little interesting Jewish tradition that comes into play here. And that is that there was no such place as Damascus until Abram came along and developed that community oasis. And that maybe, rather than Eliezer being named after the city, the city is named after Eliezer. Just a little something to chew on here. Okay, but that's a little side trip. Let's get back to the main point, and that is this. Abram says, God, I know you're my shield. I know you're my protector. I know that you've given me more than that plunder that I gave up. But I still don't have an heir. I still don't have my own son, like you told me I would have. So Eliezer is the one that's going to get all this stuff when I pass from the scene. Verse number 3. Abram said, "Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household is going to be my heir." And then behold, the word of he who is came to him. "This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir." So God says, no, Eliezer is not going to be the one that will take over your properties. You will have a physical son to take over your properties. Verse 5, he brought him outside and said, "Look toward heaven. Number the stars if you're able to number them." And of course, nobody wants to try to do that. You look at the stars, especially if you were out in a time period when there was no such thing as city haze, when nights were very dark and the sky, therefore, would be very bright, and there was not even haze from smoke that had been polluting up the sky, where it was difficult to see even the most dim stars. So the stars would have been a brilliant, brilliant latticework, carpet above his head, just full. And he wouldn't have wanted to even try. And the whole point was, you see those? That's what it's going to be like one of these days if people try to number your descendants, your offspring. And then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And that is literally true, that you wouldn't want to try to number all of Abram's kids. Because it's not just the Jewish people that are his physical descendants. We've also got a lot of the tribes of the Middle East that are descended from Abram. And not just that, every last one of us who are Gentiles, who have embraced the faith of Jesus Christ, we've been adopted into the family of Abraham, so we count in the count as well. So it is a big, big number. And then comes a very important verse in the Old Testament. It's quoted in the New Testament a couple of places. He believed he who is, and he counted it to him as righteousness. So Abram looked up on that and thought about what God was just telling him. And in his heart, he trusted God. He thought, I believe him. I will have a son for my own body, and I will have offspring that are too numerous to count. And that goes on to Abram's record, onto his spiritual account as righteousness. That is true faith, when you trust God to keep his promises and to do you right. And I think that is a perfect place for us to wrap up today. We will come back tomorrow and continue with some more things that God had to say the next time we get into God's Word.